Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. It is Friday, March 27th, 2015, just before 2:30 UTC as we're recording this. I'm Sam Minter, and Yvonne Bo is with us yet again. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello, hello. You know, it was just realizing how easily and smoothly, you know, now we get our podcast up and running and recorded, okay? And I remember when we first started this... I mean, if you guys, any of you, want to go back to the archives and pull up the first, you know, few episodes, there were train wrecks. There were technical train wrecks. I mean,
there were a few.
Oh my God.
We would routinely record whole segments, and then the thing would crash, and we wouldn't have any of it, and we'd have to try it again.
Right, and then all you'd hear is all being really pissed off and upset about the fact that we spoke for 15 minutes and none of it was saved,
We had one show in particular I remember where I forget exactly what was wrong with the microphones, but the end result of it is that, you know, you could hear Yvonne just about right, but you could hear me go...
It sounded, yes, I forgot about the Dark Vader episode. It was just, that one was, I mean, just listening to that one, I mean, if I could remember, you know, we got to go back to the archives, and we should post, like, you know, some of the highlights of some of the, some of the, or low lights at some point.
We had all kinds of miscellaneous issues as we tried different technologies for doing this, and we finally settled on, you know.
Skype.
Yeah, we're just using Skype. Well, it's Skype, and then I have some add-on software to Skype called Call Recorder that records the results of the conversation, and then I actually post-process it with several things afterwards. I use a piece of software called Levelator, which makes my volume and Yvonne's volume roughly similar to each other, which otherwise they would not be without other stuff happening. And
right,
it does some, you know, things to get the silence better. And, you know, we both bought better microphones than we had at first, although we're not, like, you know, super top of the line broadcast quality microphones, but it's good enough, right?
It's good enough. Yep.
And so it works. But anyway, we've, for the most part, the technological challenges have diminished. Every once in a while, we still have something going on, but, you know, whatever.
Not the way that we did when we first started this, no.
Anyway, we do have a plan for today. And for once, usually, you know, we record the whole show, and then at the end, I try to find, like, a phrase or something that occurred somewhere in the show to make a title out of it. But this time, we have a title right up front. It's
right.
Crash, Cruise, and Crisis.
Yes.
There you
absolutely.
Go.
Absolutely.
And so we're going to talk about the plane crash. We're going to talk about Ted Cruz announcing his candidacy for the presidency, the first major, quote-unquote, candidate to do so. And we're going to talk about the crisis in the Middle East, and it's, like, all over the place. We got stuff going on in Yemen, Iraq, Iran, Tunisia had something happen. It's not quite Middle East, but, you know, Israel, of course, follow up from that. And, and there's stuff going on other places, too. But we're just going to lump it all together, and we'll talk about the Middle East again, because there's all kinds of stuff going on. And then we'll have one of our lightning rounds. And we're gonna
try something different.
We're gonna try something a little bit different from how we've been doing. We're still trying to, like, get a handle on the lightning round to let us do it, but not let it get out of control time wise. So we're gonna play around with it a little bit more today, and that's basically the plan. Before we get started, you know, Yvonne, anything else? Anything interesting from your week going on, or whatever? You know, no.
I mean, there's just a lot of stuff going on, but, you know, nothing like really, like, I don't know. I mean, other than my, I don't know, I've been dealing with some pain, but I don't know. I still don't understand what the hell's going on. If it doesn't get any better, I have an appointment to go to the doctor next week, see if I got, like, a nerve or something is a problem.
Well, that
I don't
sucks.
Know. Yeah. Other than that,
we're both getting up there. You know, we both have aches and pains happening all the time, so...
Well, a good friend of mine said,
if you don't have if you're over 40 and you don't have aches and pains, you're dead.
That's exactly right.
See, you've used that quote before on the show. See, I remember.
Yeah.
It.
Well, you remember that one. Well, he's right. You know, I mean, it's the reality. You know, so.
Yeah. Well. Anyway, that's it for our intro segment. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk about the plane crash. Back after this.
Duh.
Okay, we're back. So obviously, as I'm sure all of you listening know, there was a plane crash in it actually. Well, yeah, Yvonne, you're the plane guy. Yeah, tell the story.
Well, it's not that complicated. Pilot goes. Yeah, well, the plane is going from Barcelona.
What was the airline? German Wings
was German the airline. Wings. Yeah, they were. And it was a flight from Barcelona to Dusseldorf, if I remember correctly.
That sounds right.
And at some point during the flight, they're at cruise, and I think the pilot. The captain either is going to the bathroom, get a cup of coffee, whatever. And and I didn't realize this, that they had put these rules in place in certain places. In the United States, there is a rule that you just don't leave.
You can't be alone in the cockpit.
You can't be alone in the cockpit.
But that's not everywhere.
It's not everywhere, and this airline didn't have that rule.
Although it may be now.
Apparently, I heard that multiple airlines in Europe just changed that rule right after this happened.
Right, because of course, so, what happened? The pilot left to go.
The pilot left. Okay, he's trying to get back. Puts in his coat, trying to get back into the cockpit, and he can't get in. The co-pilot locked it, and the co-pilot put the plane on a descent, and you know the. It's very obvious that the captain realized that the co-pilot must have lost his marbles, and he kept trying to get in. He was not allowed to get in. You could hear very loud banging and trying to get into the cockpit.
This is all from the cockpit voice recorders that they've already found.
Yep. That they already found. And all to the point they're crash. I mean, the guy wouldn't respond to the tower. You could hear the guy breathing. You could hear the guy inside the cockpit, but he didn't say one word. You know, he just put the plane.
And we know, for instance, there was some initially when they first found out the guy was locked out, they're like, could he have had a heart attack? Was there some sort of health issue? But the reason that nobody believes that anymore is that when the guy typed in his code from the outside, in order to keep the door from opening, the pilot in the cockpit has to actively hit an override button to keep the guy from coming in, because basically the cockpits are set up so that if the people in the cockpit do not want you to come in, you are not getting in.
That's right. And that's the way it was set up. I mean, we did that after September 11th, obviously, you know, for very good reasons.
Yep. And so there are a number of people saying now, you know, look, it looks like he might have had a history of depression, blah, blah, blah. A lot of this is unconfirmed yet. It's still like less than 48 hours after this happened. And so there's a lot of information. It's going to shake out over the next couple of weeks. But basically, it looks pretty strongly like, you know, as soon as the guy, the pilot left the cockpit, lock the door. Don't let him back in. It looks like he actually set the autopilot, changed the target altitude to 10 feet, and then let it go.
100 feet, I heard.
100 feet, and then just let it go.
Yep, that's it.
And then just sat there and did not respond to the guy banging at the door, did not respond to air traffic control, and it took, 10 to 15 minutes, something like that, and then it,
yeah, I think I
then
thought
it plowed
I
into the side
eight,
of a mountain.
It was like eight minutes, actually.
Eight minutes? About 10. Yeah. About 10.
Yeah. About 10. So, I mean, I don't know. It's just, look, a whole bunch of people are talking about, it's almost impossible to think of every scenario and stop every situation. Mm-hmm. You know, you have what appears a determined pilot that's decided that he wants to go and kill everybody. you know, and he's the guy in charge of the plane. It's kind of difficult to stop him. I mean, there's just I'm thinking, even if, for example, somebody else had been there in the cockpit, what if the guy decided to go, like, just freaking, like, you know, hit him, do something, attack the other person, you know? Who knows?
Well, yeah, and like, even, like, this appears to have, he set the plane for a controlled descent into the ground, but, like, if you did have both people in the cockpit, you know, all it takes is one of them, instead of doing a slow thing that's going to take 8 minutes, do something abrupt and dramatic that's going to be put the plane into an uncontrollable, unrecoverable situation.
You know, which has been done. It's happened, you know. Interesting that it doesn't happen much.
I posted something. I tweeted a link. I retweeted something just a few minutes before we started recording. In the last 40 years, for commercial jets, so not private pilots and stuff, it looks like there are 11 documented cases of jet suicides like this. And with a total of 591 dead over 40 years. You know, so it's not that common, which, like you said, is sort of surprising. It's as rare as it is. And people get very dramatic about this, but, like, the comparison this particular tweet said is that's matched every single day in the United States alone by deaths from hospital errors. And every 6 days by gun deaths. So, I mean,
right. It's a very rare occurrence. You could put
like car accidents and all this kind of stuff on this too. It's very dramatic when it happens. It's very sad when it happens, but it's incredibly rare.
I mean, you know, for example, one that I remember, there was, you know, you talked about going into a descent like that. There was this Silk Air flight that was in 1997. Silk Air, a subsidiary of Singapore Airlines, where the captain of the 737, I mean, put the plane in a freaking, like, instead of like a descent like that, it was a nosedive crash. Okay, I mean, each is, you know, put the plane straight in the nose. I think the plane partially broke up, you know, pieces started breaking off the plane before the plane just crashed into the ground. That was how hard the impact was. You know, so, and this guy committed suicide. Apparently he had some financial problems or whatever, whatnot. And the guy just, I don't know, went off the deep end.
And a number of people have pointed out when you quote unquote commit suicide like this, you know, you're one person. You're killing a couple hundred other people on the plane, right? Or, you know, it's a murder suicide at best. It's not just a suicide, you know. So because, you know, you're taking a whole plane load of people with you. Right. And so, now you said in terms of, you know, preventing these things in the future, you know, obviously, like you said, there are a couple of things they're already talking about, the sort of U.S. pattern of, you know, a second person always has to be in the cockpit. If one of the pilots leaves, a flight attendant or somebody has to come in to make sure there's always two people in there. It looks like they're doing that. I wouldn't be surprised if they look at other things too. Like you said, you can never eliminate everything. But I mean, technology is going to improve some of this over the future. I mean, we've already talked about a number of planes that have various safeguards to keep the pilots from accidentally doing something stupid. And those are going to get smarter and smarter over time. And for that matter, we may get into a situation at some point where, autopilot runs the entire flight from beginning to end and you don't even need a pilot on the plane, or you do it like a drone flight where the pilot's sitting in some office somewhere, and you can have multiple people looking over him or multiple systems. There are a number of things that, you know, as technology improves, there's going to be more capability to be able to prevent things like this from happening. But that's not tomorrow or next week.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you try to think of every scenario and it's like, yeah, I mean, it's just, you can do a lot of safeguards. We have a lot of safeguards.
Well, this is exactly how the safety industry has worked in planes and cars and a whole bunch of other things, which is that you start out dealing with, okay, let's deal with the problems that, like, you know, happen one out of every 10 flights. And, you know, like in the early days of aviation, they freaking crashed all the time.
Yes.
Okay. Then you solve all those problems. Then you're dealing with the problems that happen 1 in 100 times. Then you're dealing with the problems that happen 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000. We're now at the point with aviation safety that we're dealing when we, every time a crash happens, we're finding out some kind of weird combination of events or weird situation that happens 1 in millions, you know, maybe even more. And then they engineer safeguards to help that and push the threshold even further down. That's how safety ratchets up, is you're dealing with more and more obscure scenarios as you go. Now, having said that, pilot deciding they want to plow the plane into ground isn't all that obscure. But as we said at the beginning, it's rare. It looks like this has happened at a commercial jet plane level only 11 times in the last 40 years. That's
right.
That's if you consider the number of commercial jet flights in the world every freaking day. That's, you know, as traumatized as people are, you got to remember this is, you know, something that is so, so, so rare, you know, and people always, whenever there are dramatic plane flight, plane crashes or other incidents that happen, you always have to remind yourself, you know, because people get scared and are like, well, I'm not going to fly because it's so dangerous. The plane might crash, blah, blah, blah. Well, the most dangerous thing the average person does is get in their car. That is so far, so much more dangerous than any other thing that most people do on a daily basis,
let alone
plane flights. You know, like by an amazing amount, cars are the most dangerous thing out there. But because people are in them every single day and are so used to it, and they're like, well, you know, I drive to work every day and I haven't died yet.
And by the way, in the future, just like with aviation, they're going to get a lot safer as well. And they have gotten safer.
You have the same ratchet effect with cars. And once, you know, we every once in a while we talk about the self-driving car stuff. Once that's in place, it's going to get even safer.
Right.
You know, so there you go.
Yeah.
Anything else to say about this?
I was reading, you know, for example, to see if there were anything ever happened in a U.S. airline that was a suicide, because I remember Egypt Air, Silk Air, there was an attempted.
Didn't they think that one in New York State a while back was? Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't recall.
Okay, I thought there was a crash in upstate New York that they thought might have been that, but I might be.
Well, there was one where a crew member inside a Fed, a deadheading pilot, basically an extra pilot on a flight, had made some plot to get himself killed, you know, in order to for his family to collect his life insurance, and he wanted to make it seem like an accident, and he attacked the crew severely that none of them have ever been, they were hurt enough that the crew has not been able to fly again for work.
Wasn't there also a scenario a few years back where one of the pilots seemed to go nuts and he was subdued by the co-pilot and some of the crew and some of the passengers?
Yes, that happened actually recently. It was on a JetBlue flight, if I remember correctly. And apparently the guy had some kind of like a seizure or something. I don't know. And the guy went a little bit crazy in the plane. Yes.
There's no question it happens. It's just, like you said, it's incredibly rare. So people,
you got a lot of other things to worry about, a hell of a lot more to worrying about your pilot committing suicide, okay?
I mean, of course, having
said that, you're more likely to get killed on the way to the airport and leaving the airport.
Of course, having said that, if you knew someone on that plane, that doesn't help much. But
no, it's very unfortunate. I know, but I just think, you know, yeah.
Okay, let's take a break. We'll be back, and we'll talk about Ted Cruz. Back after Teddy. This, Teddy. You like Teddy?
Yeah.
Back after this. Hey, you listeners. We know you have thoughts about the stuff we say here on Curmudgeon's Corner. you probably think we're completely wrong about many things. Or perhaps you want to tell us that we're geniuses. That's always great. Or perhaps you just want to suggest a topic for us to talk about. All of these things are wonderful. We love to hear from you. So talk to us. If you prefer email, just email Sam. That's me, your prime curmudgeon, at abulsme@abulsme.com. That's spelled A-B-U-L-S-M-E. Or tweet at us. I'm at abulsme, and Yvonne is at I-M-B-O. That's I-M-B-O-U. And while we may not do it every time, don't be surprised if we respond to you right here on the show during an upcoming episode. Thanks, everybody. We'll be looking for your email and tweets, so get right on that. Okay, we're here again. And now we have our first major candidate to announce they are running for president.
Is he really a major candidate?
Well, I mean, come on. Here's why I say
that. He's not going to win the nomination.
Here's why I say that. If you look at actual FEC documentation of who has officially declared for president, there are approximately 150 candidates who have filed the paperwork to run for president.
Wow. Already 150?
About 150. Now, you have not heard of any of these people.
Why don't we run? See what happens.
I think you can look into it. I think it costs like $1,000 or something to file.
It's not a bad idea. I mean, it's not like we're going to win, but at least, you know.
Yep. Yeah. But anyway, so that's why you say major candidate. Like, this is somebody.
Okay, that's what you mean. Like, okay. So, okay. All right. If that's your definition, then yes, he is a major candidate.
Now, I mean, we've had other people announce their exploratory committees. Jim Webb announced his exploratory committee. A number of other people have said they're seriously considering it, blah, blah, blah. But Ted Cruz went beyond that. He's not like, he's not announcing an exploratory committee. He's saying he's in. He's running.
Right. I always, those explorator committees are, to me, are like the funniest thing. I've announced a group to analyze, to decide, to see if I will decide, to decide. I'm like, really? You know?
Well, all of this has to do with all the completely messed up campaign finance laws and disclosure laws and all this kind of thing. There are certain things that if you say a certain thing, then you have to fit into this category and you have to follow this paperwork and you have to do this stuff. And, you know, each level, you know, introduces additional sets of obligations for you and the people supporting you. And it's just a big game. And you need a team of lawyers to tell you the right time to do which things and blah, blah, blah. And it's just another sign of how messed up that system is. But, you know, that's a whole other topic. So let's talk about Ted Cruz. So he started out, he made his announcement on Twitter. The first announcement was on Twitter at midnight, overnight. He put out a tweet with his first sort of campaign video thing and saying that he's running. And then the next morning, he gave his first official, like, I'm running speech at Liberty University, which is Jerry Falwell's college, for those of you who don't remember that, and a very religiously conservative school, etc. And the thing I found interesting about that is a big auditorium, all of this, but it was a mandatory event for all students at the college. That's how he filled the seats. Yes. So the stadium he was talking in was completely full, but it's because all students were required to attend.
Oh, come on!
And what was interesting about that, there were a number of pictures of, like, him speaking and, like, you see the crowd behind him and, like, a whole bunch of them had, like, Rand Paul t-shirts.
That's beautiful.
You know, and there were a whole bunch of them. You know, there's this app that's popular on college kids to do sort of anonymous commenting on things. It's like, you know, we talked a little bit about the Secret app a few months ago, and there are a couple other competitors. This one, KitKat, maybe it is. I'm forgetting. But anyway, there were a number of people in the audience doing live snarky comments while he gave his speech as well, or just complaining that they had to come to this thing. So that was amusing. Also amusing was the fact that his official website, I believe, is at tedcruz.org, but he neglected to reserve tedcruz.com.
So what is he going to have to use?
Well, he's using tedcruz.org, but the guy who owns tedcruz.com put up, like, you know, basically a pro-Obama website there.
Oh, I love it. That's great.
And then someone else, of course, grabbed tedcruz.ca for Canada, because, of course, there's also the whole he was born in Canada thing.
Right.
So tedcruz.com just says support President Obama, immigration reform now. That's the entirety of the website. There's a lot of, like, things around here where he's not quite as smooth as he might like. He probably didn't appreciate the pictures of the Rand Paul people behind him at his opening speech. The website's probably not, you know, perfect here. And basically he's staking out, it appears, the religious conservative wing of the party specifically, and the Tea Party wing of the party are the sort of areas he's going after. Let's just bring up the Canada thing real quick, because, of course, like, there are two aspects of this. One, of course, there are people who immediately are saying, you know, he's not eligible. He was born in Canada. We got the same kind of situation as we had with Obama. A bunch of people have been watching out for, like, who are the people who spent the last 8 years complaining about Obama's birth certificate and blah, 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 blah. But Ted Cruz, oh, that's fine. And there are a bunch of people sort of in that category. But I'll give them credit. There are a few people who are being consistent here. Donald Trump is being consistent. He was going after Obama and saying, you know, he's not eligible because he might have been born in Kenya. And he's going after Ted Cruz on this, too, because he was born in Canada. All of this relates to the fact that the natural-born citizen, which the Constitution requires, is not actually defined in the Constitution. And there's, a whole bunch of arguments that have been made that says, for instance, if it's similar to British common law, then natural-born does not simply mean they were born as a citizen, which both Ted Cruz and Obama were, and Obama would have been even if he was born in Kenya.
Well, I mean, there's a discussion about whether, for example, I'm a natural-born citizen.
Because you were born in a territory.
Yeah, and even though, when I was, I've been a U.S. citizen since birth, and a son of U.S. citizens.
Yep.
That has been a question. As a matter of fact, there were a number of people to this day in Puerto Rico that I know. No Puerto Rican born in Puerto Rico has tried to run for president.
Right.
But there had been, like, some people pushing the previous governor to actually run as a Republican. Okay, all right.
Just to test the issue.
No. Because apparently a whole bunch of Republicans liked them. I don't know why.
Okay. Well, anyway.
But anyway, the bottom line is that we're debating whether that would have had to go to the Supreme Court to get a decision on whether we're eligible or not.
Here's the thing. The Supreme Court would probably never actually take this case. They've shown in election eligibility cases in the past, they've basically said no one has any standing on this issue until after somebody is elected. And then after somebody is elected, they would probably be extremely reluctant to overturn an election.
Right, correct.
And so the idea is basically that on eligibility issues.
Okay, but who accepts the – okay, great.
So I decide
I'm going to run for president, right?
Yes.
Doesn't somebody go and ask me, hey, could you prove, you know – give us your citizenship information.
So basically the precedent on this issue seems to be that the only check on eligibility is, in fact, the voters. And the voters in the end, if someone tries to run who's clearly ineligible, the voters should not elect them. And if they do, then obviously they don't care, and the guy won. But that seems a little self-contradictory, but I think a lot of it is just the courts do not want to get involved in this kind of thing.
And but they are true. I mean, the reality is that if, you know, if it came out that the person wasn't, like, really, you know, I mean, they wouldn't wind up voting him in the first place.
Right, because sort of people believe that this would get taken care of by the process, you know, because the main reason this is in the Constitution at all, well, it's not really talked about very much. Like, compared to most other parts of the Constitution, there's very little contemporary discussion of the qualifications. In fact, I read an article this week that said there was none. They can't find anything by any of the people who are actually involved in writing a Constitution explaining what they were thinking when they wrote the qualifications. You know, and so, you know, but the thought is basically you're looking to sort of make sure that you've got somebody who's fundamentally, like, loyal to the country. You don't want to have the scenario where a non-citizen or somebody whose loyalties are not 100% behind the country sort of gets in and starts meddling with the process. So everybody sort of agreed that it has to be somebody who was born a citizen is basically the consensus interpretation of this clause, though.
Right.
And in that case, because, you know, frankly, you know, McCain wasn't born in the country. He was born in Panama, in the canal zone, but in Panama. You know, Obama, by the way, was born in the United States. But even if he was born in Kenya, he still would have been a natural born citizen.
Been eligible, exactly, regardless.
Yeah, right. Cruz was not. Mitt Romney's father was born in Mexico when he ran for president.
Correct.
And there have been a number of other examples over time. So, I mean, this is one of those things that's a complete non-issue, and anybody who's actually, you know, spending time criticizing Cruz for this issue is just proving how silly they are. And I'm looking at you, Donald Trump, and others. But because God knows there are plenty of real reasons to criticize Ted Cruz.
Yeah. I mean, there are plenty of that. The guy's a moron. I mean, let's be clear.
So, yeah, I mean, he's, you know, I don't know. I mean, he's sort of, to me, he represents the worst of this part of the Republican Party in terms of, you know, anti-science, anti-modernity in all kinds of different areas. You know, they're Republicans that I certainly respect. This wing of the Republican Party is not one of them. Ted Cruz exemplifies it in many ways.
I mean, look at some of the lines that he threw in the announcement. Imagine abolishing the IRS, for example.
Yeah, I might not mind that if it was replaced by something reasonable, but let's get real. It's not going to happen.
Come on, but let's get real. I mean, come on. Look, as much as I don't like the damn IRS, and you know I've had my issues with these guys, okay, all right, look, I mean, I think it's a preposterous idea to just abolish the IRS, okay?
Hey, go ahead, you have more quotes?
Let's see, let me see if you, imagine young people coming out of school with 4, 5, or 6 job offers, because somehow, apparently, he's going to be magically, I don't know, I mean, I don't know, but you and I came out of college. We have 6 job offers?
I did not.
I did not. I don't know any. I mean, this is what kind of a ridiculous line is this?
Okay, go ahead. More.
Let's see. No, those are just the ones that I saw. I don't see anything else.
Yeah,
I
mean, there was something about climate change. And the other thing that came up this week is, you know, he's going to repeal Obamacare on the first day. And then, of course, the next day it comes out.
Oh, right. Because
he's signing up for Obamacare because his wife is leaving her Wall Street job. Now, of course, I think this this criticism is also somewhat bullshit, by the way, in that, you know, people have pointed out that there are legal alternatives. He didn't have to do Obamacare. There are other legal alternatives. But other people are saying, you know, oh, he's following a law that he doesn't like. Isn't that what you're supposed to do? You know, it is the law. He's supposed to follow it. And so, you know, people are trying to paint him as hypocritical for this. And
wait a minute. She left her Wall Street job. She could have signed up for COBRA if he doesn't like Obamacare. I'm sorry. But start off with that. So I'm sorry.
Is that still there? That Obamacare didn't get rid of COBRA?
No. COBRA still exists. And my point is, why did he sign up for Obamacare? Guess probably why. Take a guess.
It's cheaper.
Yes!
Yeah, like I said, there are legal alternatives that he could have done. I mean, or of course he could go uninsured and pay the extra fee when he pays his taxes.
Since he doesn't believe that insurance is important enough that people should be able to easily get it, he could have gone uninsured as well.
But nevertheless, like the people who are like giving him a hard time about this,
he gets a hard time for a very good reason.
Well, you see, I don't necessarily buy that because like I can disagree with the law, but still... You know, take advantage of it.
No. Hold on. There's one thing where you're talking about a law that it's like the speed limit or a law against, you know, hey, no smoking in this building with prohibit. So there's one thing about a law like that. OK, this is a law where, like you just said, he had options. He's against the program. Right?
Right.
And the program is for you to go to a marketplace, really, and allow you to buy insurance. And oh, by the way, even though that marketplace is there, he still had other options for her to have coverage.
And for him to have coverage. Which would
have been COBRA. And you know what? He went and took the route that he found cheapest, which is the damn program that he so freaking despises. If he really was so against it, he should have just paid COBRA. Be so against it.
Yeah, well, that's along the same lines. The other similar argument you hear every election cycle is about candidates accepting matching funds. And there are a number of candidates who are against public financing of election or against matching funds, but most of them take the matching funds anyway. And the argument is, I disagree with the law, but as long as it's the law, I'd be stupid. I would be putting myself at a disadvantage.
But you could reject the matching funds.
You could, the argument is, you know,
if you are so against it on the principle, then you should go ahead and reject them. If it's the principle of it, that the reason why you're doing it. I'm sorry.
Well, there you go. We're over time here.
As usual.
As usual. Anything else to say about Cruz?
Oh, no.
He has no chance.
He has no shot.
Just for the record, he's not going to win the nomination. If he did win the nomination, he'd lose the general election. He's not, he doesn't have
He doesn't have like one iota of likability or charisma. I mean, that's the reality.
There is a constituency in the Republican Party for him, but it's not super large.
No, it's not. Okay, it's just a lot. It's very difficult to like a jerk. Okay,
and
he's a big one.
And in the general election, there haven't been all that many. Like he's number six on my list of the top five best polled. So the polling's not that great still. But it shows him, you know, losing to Clinton by a pretty healthy margin.
Oh my God, he'd get like just absolutely massacred.
Yeah, so, yeah, he's not going to win. There are many of the Republican candidates that, have a shot, some more than others. It would take a miracle of other candidates blowing themselves up for Cruz to somehow end up with the nomination.
Yeah, it would be stunning.
I mean, like you have to figure out.
If Ted Cruz got the nomination. Look, I have a piece of paper over here with the topics I wrote today. I will eat one of these pieces of paper.
Okay, we've written that down.
Okay.
But like even in like the religious conservative space, like, you know, Huckabee is a lot more charismatic.
And likable.
I mean, like, yes. I disagree with Huckabee on lots of stuff. But when I've watched him on television, it's like, oh, he's a nice guy.
Yeah, he's kind of fun, exactly. Yeah. But this guy, he's just an irritating jackass. I mean, it's just, nothing else that you can say about it. I mean, it's just, I mean, you're like there, you're like just begging, my God, could this be over?
Okay, we're taking a break. We will be back momentarily. And what was our third topic, Yvonne?
Crisis.
Crisis. The Middle East. Everything's exploding. We'll be back after this to talk about it.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
And we're back. So we got the Middle East. We've got dramatic things happening in Yemen. We've got dramatic things happening in Iraq. We've got the Iran talks coming up against their deadline in just a few days. We had a terrorist attack in Tunisia. We have Benjamin Netanyahu continuing his apology tour for the things that he said right before the election.
God, yes.
And we have the Obama administration basically not accepting the apology so far. Part of that, a story leaked this last week about the Israelis spying on the talks with Iran, and not only spying on the talks with Iran, but specifically leaking information from that
to the Republicans
in Congress to try to scuttle the deal. Right. So we got all these things happening in the Middle East. Where do you want to start, Yvonne?
Let's start with a BB apology tour.
Okay, go for it.
Well, I mean, okay, so the guy goes to an election, right? And he's saying all of this stuff, right, that he was saying. He was talking about the Arabs, going to vote, going off. And now, and then like, the, what was it, like 2 days before the election, he says, no Palestinian state. I never meant it. Forget it. You know, I'm not, whatever. And now he's like, oh, well, I really didn't mean any of it. I'm like, really? Really? I don't know. What do you think?
I think we have... Yeah, I think this, what he said right before the election represents his true opinions more than anything he's said in the entire time he's been prime minister.
I would agree with you.
I think it's the other stuff that's sort of the BS that, you know... okay, yeah, peace process, rah-rah, two-state solution, blah, blah, blah. and I don't think he ever really believed it. He was never interested in pursuing that direction. If he had been, things would have moved a lot further. I think it's probably very true that he is upset that the Arabs vote in Israel. And maybe it's okay for them to vote as long as they don't matter.
Right.
But at a second, they're big enough that it matters. Well, that's a problem.
That's a problem.
And this is actually, you know, this ends up being sort of the fundamental issue of this whole Israel-Palestine situation is that there is a choice here between, you know, okay, let's look at the two-state solution. One of the main purposes of the two-state solution is to enable sort of a Jewish predominant Israel to remain because, you know, basically by international law, I mean, they occupied these territories. They either have the responsibility to get out and let them do their own thing or actually take ownership of the territory and then give the people their rights.
What I don't understand is to this day is, okay, Bibi says that he's against the Palestinian state, or they're not ready for the state.
What's
okay,
this
or whatever.
Alternative?
Yeah. So, what's this alternative? Either what's this alternative, or what the hell does it take to make it ready? Because he doesn't say what it'll take, or what the hell the other option is. I keep going. I'm like, real. I mean, you know, I swear to God. I mean, almost. I'm like, listen, Bibi, what are you advocating? Like genocide? I mean, what the hell, man?
Well, I think. I don't know whether there's been an explicit statement or not, but I mean, and I joked last week, it's like convert them all to Judaism. But no, I think really it's, fully accept the state of Israel, be ready to live in peace. Completely squash any form of militancy. And I think what the other things that he seems to want to require of any potential Palestinian state, which are, of course, unacceptable to the Palestinians, is he doesn't want to give up control of their borders. He wants to control trade in and out of that country.
But that's unacceptable. That's unacceptable.
Yeah, I mean, basically, he wants a state that's not a state. He wants a state that's still completely, that under no circumstances would be able to actually thrive to the point that it could be a threat.
Right.
You know, not allowed to have their own military, constraints on foreign policy, blah, 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 other things like that. I think that's the problem is, of course, his definition of what would be a Palestinian state he would accept involves restrictions that make it not really a full state.
Right.
Not really a full equal country.
Right. That doesn't make sense. So
now what are alternatives? Like I said, if you really go for a one state solution, well, you either become a true democracy, in which case all of the Palestinians get to vote as well, and you may or may not end up with a Jewish-led government.
Right.
Probably not, in fact, if you actually let everybody in the West Bank and Gaza Strip vote equally with citizens of the current Israel. So that's probably not the kind of one-state solution that Bibi or anybody else would be envisioning either. Or you have one state, but you have some sort of apartheid situation with second-class citizens who are restricted. I mean, essentially, that's the situation we actually have on the ground today.
Hello.
So you had to start the show by saying how good our tech had been lately.
So
Yvonne goes, and his computer has a kernel panic, and boom.
Which I haven't had in, like, I don't know how long. Who knows?
So, we were talking about Israel, and I was basically saying that Israel has a choice of is it going to be democratic long term, or is it going to be ethnically Jewish long term? And it's eventually going to have to decide, even within the territory of Israel proper, but unless you have a two-state solution with the West Bank and Gaza Strip, that becomes even more of an issue because essentially the situation you've got today is an apartheid-type situation where you've got a whole population with very dramatic restrictions on what they can do because they aren't able to act as an independent state. They're also not able to act as Israeli citizens. So they're just out of luck in all kinds of different ways. And that's not necessarily to justify violent response and throwing rockets at Israel or anything like that either. But it's not a good situation for the Palestinians. And long term, that means it's not a good situation for the Israelis either. At some point, the Israelis have to realize that the best way to actually get a secure, thriving state is for the Palestinians to be secure and thriving too.
Yep. Well, anyway, all right. So that's Israel. We have a lot more stuff going on in the Middle East. So Yemen. You talk about it because I still don't understand why they're all fighting over in Yemen.
Well, yeah, I read a couple.
I know they are fighting. I just don't know why.
And look, I'm not going to claim to understand that either. I mean, there's long-term historical things going back decades. There's the Sunni-Shia thing. There are individual personalities involved. You've got the two major groups there, and then you've got Al-Qaeda in the mix, too. And you've got issues relating to parts of the population not liking the fact that the Americans had been in there with all kinds of capacities up until a couple weeks ago. There are people who are, you know, pushing against Saudi influence. There are people pushing against Iranian influence. It's all a big freaking mess with all kinds of competing things. And now you've got, people keep saying it's on the verge of breaking into civil war. And I'm like, verge of what? This is an outright civil war. How does anybody pretend it's not? And it has been for a while now. And what you've got, the addition this week are the quote unquote rebels drove the president right out of the country, took over a lot more territory. And now Saudi Arabia and a coalition of 10 other Arab countries have been intervening militarily with air power. And now there's talk of potentially over 100,000 actual ground troops potentially getting involved. This is just, you know, this is an all-out war. Or it's
an all-out war. Totally. Absolutely. Yes.
And I just see it as a huge mess. I actually appreciate that so far. I mean, the U.S. basically skedaddled out of there a couple weeks ago. And while there have been some people talking about the U.S. getting back involved, for the most part, it's Saudi Arabia who's doing this war. Saudi Arabia and with a bunch of allies, but they're the ones who are pushing it. And as far as I'm concerned, and this will be a theme when we talk about the other areas too, even though the U.S.'s response is different so far, I think keep the hell out of it is actually the right thing to do here. You know, whatever's going to happen, let it happen. The further away from it we can be, the better.
Right.
Because I don't see how our involvement can help in any way, shape, or form. I frankly think that the involvement.
I don't. You're right. I mean, this is a cluster. I mean, I don't know what the heck we could do there.
I mean, even the fact that Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, all of these countries are getting involved militarily there. I don't think they help either necessarily. People say, well,
I don't think Saudi Arabia is going in there to help. They're going in there to try to like put a lid on it because it's right under border and they don't want it spilling into their country, period.
Well, yeah. And of course, you know, the Iran's in the mix here, too.
Right.
And we're going to talk about the U.S., ISIS, and Iran and Iraq a few minutes from now. But, you know, part of this is, you know, on this side, we may be helping the Saudis fight against forces that are supported by the Iranians. While meanwhile, in Iraq, we're actually tacitly supporting the Iranians as they fight against ISIS.
Right.
And then we've got, my head is spinning with all the different groups that are involved here and what's going on. And, you know, I certainly I'm not conversant enough to make intelligent heads or tails over this. I'd have to spend quite a bit of time, you know, reading up on it just to have a cursory view, let alone be an actual expert. And I look at all of this and I'm like, stay away, stay as far away as we can. Let this play out however it's going to play out. But, you know, any involvement whatsoever by us is counterproductive. And I don't know, maybe the result is Al-Qaeda takes over Yemen. Oh, well, you know, I mean, we'll deal with that when it happens. But
it's not like it's something that we can't deal with. I mean, OK, great. But I don't think like you said right now. This seems to be like basically a massive civil war. And then we've got a whole bunch of, and it's being a proxy war in between a lot of different Middle Eastern countries. Yeah. I don't see what that, exactly. Us going in there, we're not helping anything.
Right. We would make things so much worse.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And we'll see how, whether this is a short thing that plays out over the course of a couple of weeks and is done, or whether this is going to be another long simmering conflict that lasts for years and years and years. Not like we don't have enough of those, but, okay. So next up is Iraq. And as I alluded a few minutes ago, there's been this push on the city of Tikrit, which has been militias that were set up by the Iraqi government, which are actually heavily supported by Iran, who are basically doing this offensive. The U.S. had basically been staying out of it, saying, you know, we didn't think this was quite the right timing for that, but let them go, but we're not going to get involved. Until a couple days ago, when that offensive had sort of stalled out, and apparently the Iraqi government said, "Hey, U.S., can you help?" And so now we're getting involved with air power there too, which effectively means that we're acting as the air force for the Iranian-supported and in some cases commanded militia forces that are fighting against ISIS.
It's crazy shit.
Like I said, meanwhile, we're supporting Saudi Arabia fighting against the essentially the same people.
Right.
Not exactly the same people, but also Iranian-backed in some situations. And it's like, I retweeted something from somebody a while back. Because it was also pointed out, I tweeted an article about this as well, that a significant number of the commanders on the ground who are fighting against ISIS right now, who we're essentially providing air support for, are actually on U.S. terrorist watch lists because they were also the primary opposition that was fighting against American forces when America was in Iraq a few years ago. Okay, the thing I retweeted was, did we learn absolutely nothing from, you know, essentially funding bin Laden when he was fighting in Afghanistan in the 1980s? You know, this is all like, you know, sort of marriages of convenience where we're supporting one team, we're supporting the other. We're doing the same kind of thing in Syria where we're, and it's none of these people are ones that particularly are fine, upstanding, democratic, this is what we'd like to see in the future kind of things, you know. So it's more like it's their scumbags versus our scumbags. And except there are three or four different factions there. And this is, again, a situation where, you know, I hear all these neocon types talking about how we need to be more involved. We need to be more involved. We need to take leadership. We need to be stronger. We need to provide leadership. You know,
Yes. Bombs.
But I look at all of this, and this includes the anti-ISIS thing in Iraq, and of course Syria as well. Where I'm like, how does what we're doing make this better? And I realize, okay, maybe we kill some bad guys. And, you know, no one denies that ISIS is pretty bad.
Yes.
But it seems like we're just, to use cliches, we're adding fuel to the fire by any involvement we have. And by us taking sides, the way that we meddle and involve ourselves guarantees that we end up with more enemies years from now. And also, even the people that we're supporting and providing with support, you know, aren't folks we really like all that much either. So what are we doing here? Leave it all alone. Whatever happens will happen. It'll be unfortunate. I'm sure tons of people will die, but I'm not convinced us being involved will make less people die. We'll probably make more people die. So wash our hands of it, get the hell out. But
look, I don't know if like washing our hands will make will make it better. Look, most of the time that we try to leave these situations like without doing anything, sometimes it winds up biting, coming back to bite us. So I don't know.
And even the stuff we've done within the last couple years, where we've provided arms and weapons and vehicles to various groups in here that we've been supporting, even if those groups themselves haven't turned on us, when they've lost, the other side has gotten those weapons too.
Right.
And so, you know, this whole region is full of, on all sides, of weapons provided by the Americans. How does this help?
Well, anyway, we're not going to solve it today, but it's a mess. Bottom line, it's a big mess. We don't know where the hell's going to end. Big, messy.
So I know we're way over and we went over extra because you crashed, but Tunisia, there's not much to say other than it was a big attack there. People died. The one other thing that I did want to get a little bit of thoughts on is this whole, the Israelis were spying on the Iran talks, and we found out because we were spying on the Israelis. And we also found out that the Israelis were providing information to Republicans in Congress. What do you think of all this?
I don't know.
I found it interesting that the article in the Wall Street Journal that revealed all this, it took pains to say that the American officials were like, you know, we don't really mind the spying. We expect the spying, and we're spying on them, too. The only thing we mind is the fact that they were telling Congress. And meanwhile, of course, there's a counterargument. Well, okay, well, telling Congress is kind of scummy, but at the same time, does that mean we're intentionally withholding information from Congress, and is that okay? You know?
Well, I think it goes back to one of those things where when you're in the middle of a negotiation, and I've seen this before, where you get just a slice of the picture, and so therefore you're creating opposition without giving a true full picture, because you go and you spy on it, right? And then you selectively reveal what you want, right? Okay, to them, which is going to be the stuff that is going to probably sound the worst, and then create a mess of a situation in the middle of a negotiation. I think it's really. You know, how is that good for our relation? Okay.
Well, I'd step back. You know, everybody sort of acknowledges, okay, everybody spies on everybody. But, you know, I don't know that it's healthy that we accept that as the standard to start from. Now, I understand as well that...
I know that's a reality.
Israel also defended themselves and said, you know, we in fact were not directly spying on the Americans. We were spying on the Iranians who came home to report on what was happening with the negotiations with the Americans.
Right.
You know, and so, okay, but this... I don't know how much we can hold ourselves sort of up high either here, not on the spying, but even on the, you know, submitting information to Congress. I mean, do you honestly think our intelligence services aren't feeding intelligence to various groups in countries all over the world that we want to support against various oppositions against their governments if we're unhappy with the government that's in power? I'm sure we are.
Yeah. Well, anyway, well, it is what it is. I mean, I don't know. I just think...
But I will say, one thing on this is, though, the fact that this was leaked right now and seems to have been leaked deliberately by the Obama administration seems to be clearly sort of another salvo in the worsening relationships between the U.S. and Israel, where, you know, Bibi's going on his apology tour, like we were talking about, and the Americans are basically like, yeah, we're done with you. And you know, here's what you were doing, and we're going to make that public that you were doing this. And yeah, we don't believe your apology either. We believe you've shown your true stripes, and we're going to act accordingly. And I don't know how long that'll last, whether that'll continue for the rest of the Obama administration or things will cool off. I saw one report that, like, when the president of Israel officially said, okay, please form a government, Mr. Netanyahu, they also said, and please go patch up the relationship with the United States. This is not good, but we'll, yeah.
I think short term it's got to stay like this, but they're going to make him grovel and beg.
Yeah.
If he wants to improve the situation at this point. I mean, you know, so... Yeah. They're going to make him grovel and beg. So...
Okay, let's take a break. We'll be back with our lightning round. Back after this. Okay, we are back. So here's how we're going to do the lightning round this time. The timer is set at 1 minute. Yvonne and I are going to alternate picking topics. And then when we get to 10 minutes total into this round, or maybe we'll go to 15, but when we get to the end, we're stopping. We've got a big, long list of lightning round items, but we don't expect to get to the end. I just sent Yvonne the list again, and we are going to alternate taking turns on which of these topics we decide to talk about. So, Yvonne, why don't you go for the first minute, pick a topic, and then I'll start the timer.
Feedback on show length.
Okay, feedback on show length. Last week, right after the show, I posted a post on Is Curmudgeon's Corner Getting Longer? And I asked for feedback at the end on what length people like. We got two pieces of feedback from that. My mom, who'd given a lot of feedback last time, said 30 to 60 sounds great to her. Bruce, another longtime listener, said that for him, 60 to 90 sounded good. So those are the two pieces of feedback we got on it. I think we're kind of targeting 60 to 90 at this point.
Yes.
So, we'll see.
Next.
Okay, my pick.
Yes.
We'll go right down this line. We also got feedback from the Supercut. I got two pieces of feedback from the Supercut. One was from Matt, another longtime listener, who said he really enjoyed the Supercut and liked the editing and thought it was funny. And the other, Yvonne, was from your wife. Your wife, Juana, she actually commented on your Facebook post about this and said, thank you, Sam's mom.
Yes, I think she was thankful that apparently she's trying to get me to curb my cursing.
And you've done a remarkable job this week, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, I don't usually notice it. So for all I know, you've been swearing the whole time and it just went right over my head.
I don't know.
Okay. Next, your pick again, Yvonne.
Apple TV.
Okay. We talked last week about rumors about the Apple TV service. This week there were rumors about a new Apple TV device.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, this one has been out almost for 3 years. I mean, it would have been shocking if they hadn't. I mean, I'd been shocked it's taken this long to launch a new one.
And
so, yeah,
the rumors are out this summer, I believe.
Yep.
And we'll have a lot more onboard memory for storing stuff. It'll have an app store, new remote, possibly game controllers. I don't know. And of course, all the stuff they were talking about the Apple TV service. And they keep adding channels. They just added another channel this week. It's like channels are being added like constantly to this thing at this point. So it's well overdue. Anything else to say about it?
Not really.
Okay.
You pick.
My pick. The other feedback from Matt, again, our longtime listener, he said, I'd asked about feedback on whether the timestamps were helpful. He said he never noticed them. He just plays it in on his iPhone or whatever, and so he never even sees the blog posts. So I'd originally put it in because at least one person said it might be useful, but we'll see. It takes me about 2 extra minutes to throw those in each week, so maybe I'll do it anyway. I don't know. He also, for daylight savings time, he was amused by our comments, said he was reminded of it by, I guess, John Oliver did a bit on daylight savings time on his HBO show. He asked me if I'd seen it. I had not seen it. But John Oliver's usually pretty good, so.
Yeah, his show is pretty good.
I'm surprised if he's taken on daylight savings time. Hopefully that means it'll be gone soon. But.
Well, I don't know.
Okay, Yvonne, your pick.
The Russian Rights Summit. So I was telling Sam because I saw this post. So apparently, the Russians decided to invite all sorts of crazies that apparently love Russia and hate the West, but that are not really Russians, to come to Russia to basically vent. And this was like one of the craziest collections of psychos and lunatics, okay, as all assembled in one place, okay? You know, quite a lot of people who were like massively homophobic, crazy, like neo-Nazi styles, all sorts of wacky, crazy people. And they even paid, like, I know that there was apparently one guy who was a right-wing Republican that apparently got paid to go there, and then when he realized, shit, they didn't tell me who the hell was in attendance in advance. He was like, the hell's a bunch of nut jobs. I'm just curious. I just keep wondering, what the hell? Really? This is, I mean, how, I'm trying to think. So Putin really thinks that this really reflects well on him when these are the allies that you could cobble together?
Yep.
God.
Okay. My turn. I saw another movie. I watched Escape to Witch Mountain from 1975, the Disney movie.
And?
It was okay. It was cute. It showed its age. The special effects were, like, awful. I hadn't even realized this was a theatrical movie as opposed to a made-for-TV movie. I would have watched it anyway if it was made-for-TV, but I found out while watching it. It was actually a movie in the theaters. Of course, it came out when I was 4 years old, and so I only saw it ever on TV after that. But, you know, it's the kids with magic powers who, you know, are in an orphanage, and they end up running away, and it turns out they're aliens. Sorry, spoilers.
Spoilers. The movie came out in 1975. I think you can spoil it.
Anyway, yeah. Okay, movie. Like, if you don't, I watched it because I kind of remembered it from when I was a kid, and I was like, let's check it out. If you don't already have sort of some kind of warm, fuzzy memories about it, don't bother.
Yeah.
Okay, your turn.
Aaron Schock resigned. So okay. Is this the I think this is the congressman, the one that decorated his office, looked like TV show. Yeah.
Yes, that was him.
Here's the thing.
That's okay. Not why he resigned.
He said, yeah, but apparently it all started with that. It said, I still don't understand why the hell he resigned.
Basically, more and more evidence was coming out of financial malfeasance. So the Downton Abbey thing was one thing. He'd spent lots of taxpayer money on that. After it came out, he paid it back. More recently, things were happening that, it came out that, for instance, he'd expensed miles on his car. He'd expensed like something like 150,000 miles of travel on his car. But then somebody got the public records for the sale of his car, and it only had 80,000 miles on it when he sold the car.
Ooh.
And there were a bunch of other things along those lines where he was basically using taxpayer money for personal gain. And there was a flight. He took gave him a private jet flight somewhere or another, and he expensed it, but he listed it as software.
So the guy's basically a crook.
Yeah, basically. And his the quote I love is his dad, after this happened, was interviewed on TV, and he talked for a while about his son and, you know, how blah, blah, blah. But his one quote that was memorable was, you know, he'll do okay. In 2 or 3 years, he'll be doing great again, unless he's in jail. Okay.
Gee, Dad, thanks.
Okay, my turn. I read a book, except I didn't read it. I listened to it. It was an audiobook again, called Writing on the Wall by Tom Standage. It's a book about the history of social media. It basically looks at Facebook, Twitter, all these things in a long-term historical perspective, starting at like how Roman families wrote letters to each other during the Roman Empire days, to the printing press and then mass media in the 20th century and all this stuff, and how basically the era of mass media in the 20th century was actually the exception, where there was sort of highly centralized control of information flow, whereas almost throughout the rest of history, it's been much more like the social media we have today, with individuals passing along news to each other in various ways. And so this is kind of a return to that history. I'll tell you, the concept was kind of interesting. I'm not sure the execution was all that great. Because it ended up being just as much a history of media as of social media, although he's making those social media points. Also, I noticed until the very last few chapters when he talked about social media, in China and in you know, the Arab Spring and stuff. It was almost all Europe and the United States, and I'm like, there was none of this going on in the rest of the world throughout the rest of history. And so, but it was okay. But you probably have the main concept of it just from listening to me give my 1 minute review. And so I probably wouldn't recommend it unless you're really into that. Okay, your turn. And we're at the 10 minute mark. We'll stop at 15 no matter what. Go.
Bergdahl.
Go for it.
So Bergdahl, I don't know. So now they are going to accuse him of deserting.
Yes.
Well,
look. Well, and there, a lot of people were saying this right up front, that this is what happened. The interesting part of it, I thought, was that the Obama administration went through so much trouble to try to say that wasn't what was going on at first. And then they said, well, there'll be an investigation. But why did so many people in the Obama administration go out on a limb to defend this guy? Because, I mean, even if he was a deserter, you can make
a case. We still needed to bring him back.
You still could make the case that we still needed to bring him back.
That's what I kept saying. It doesn't matter whether he's a deserter or not.
But what was interesting here is the Obama administration at the time didn't say, you know, he might be a deserter. He might have done bad things. He might have been outstanding. We don't know. We're going to save him anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think they said some of that.
I
guess they felt they were kind of like on their heels, and they decided to try to defend him even though, you know,
there was lots of evidence against him from the very beginning. That, you know, basically, you know, the guy deserted and got into trouble. And, you know, but again, like, that shouldn't have made a difference because, okay, the guy deserted and then got himself into a lot more trouble than he expected. But, you know, going back and getting him anyway was the right thing to do regardless. But the Obama administration dug themselves a hole by, you know, defending him as if he was a hero of some sort. So, okay.
You.
My turn. Primera. We have another healthcare company that leaked tons and tons of information. Someone hacked them. But again, it's an issue of bad security. And apparently before the leak happened, they were being warned about security holes and they should take it. And by the way, full disclosure, Primera is my healthcare company.
Oh, lovely.
And I got all the notices in the mail of like, your information may have been compromised, blah, blah, blah. They're offering some sort of free sort of identity protection service for a year or something like that. But it's like, come on, companies. You get a clue. How many of these have to happen before?
A lot.
Before
they don't care. Yeah. I told, like I said before, they don't give a shit.
Well, because they just, okay, it's a cost of business. We'll have it. We'll buy insurance for this when it happens. We'll, you know, right. like here, they're offering everybody identity protection. Oh, thanks.
Right.
You know, that helps. How about stopping it from happening in the first place? But no, because really being secure about these things would take a lot of money. And culture changes and all kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, anyway, screwed. All right.
Okay. Your turn. And this is probably the last one. Maybe one more after this. We'll see how fast you go.
Lewinsky TED Talk. What did she say? I heard a little bit about it and I heard some comments around it, but I've been meaning to
actually watch the talk. I haven't watched the talk yet, but apparently she gave a TED Talk that was basically anti-bullying, specifically anti-internet bullying, talking about how the current culture of this makes it very easy to go after people and do this, and bringing up her own experiences during the Clinton administration as an example of how this can be bad, and how, you know, she was a young, innocent, naive person, made a mistake, and then the next day she was on the front page of the papers and was demonized, and
I know.
It basically ruined her life, and she was on the verge of suicide a couple of times. And apparently, from all reports, and I really have to make a point of watching this thing, apparently it was very, very good. And
that's what I've heard.
And very well done. And she did a good showing for herself. And she ended it with and you can take control of your own story, and which is obviously what she's trying to do. And good for her.
And good for her. I agree. Yeah. You know. I mean, she got really. She's been like tortured and treated like crap by a lot of people for no particular good reason whatsoever. So anyway,
and all that is the end of our lightning round. We don't have time for any more. 15 minutes is enough of this. We don't have to go through. Our list is longer, but we have decided this is enough.
This is enough. All right. Okay. So that's it.
So thanks everybody for joining us yet again for Curmudgeon's Corner. We appreciate it. Look, we had feedback today from 4 different people. I think that's a new record for one show.
Yes, it is.
So we appreciate all of you listeners. Thank you. Continue to send us feedback. Abelsmay@abelsmay.com for me. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Abelsmay. Yvonne is at I am Bo. Yvonne, are you ready to say anything about the Facebook page?
We have a Facebook page. It's what's the name of it? It's Curmudgeon's Corner.
Curmudgeon's Corner. We have a Facebook page. Yeah. I just put it up last week. We haven't really done much with it yet, but please like us on Facebook as well.
Please.
Basically, we'll post the show announcements there and any other sort of thing that we feel like, but probably mainly the show announcements. We'll see if you have suggestions for other things you'd want to see there.
Yeah, put news stories and some other stuff. Perhaps we'll start putting it there when we talk about something that we want to share. We'll put it there.
Now, that's a good idea. Like if we actually talk about an article, maybe put it up there.
Right? Exactly.
Of course, that might be more work, but.
But, we'll work our way somewhere.
Yeah, so like us on Facebook, please, and share it with your friends. We'll see who, let's get some followers. Woo!
Woo!
This is part of our vast plan to take over the media world.
The world! Oh, no. Anyway.
We'll be bigger than, what's that Australian dude?
Australian dude? Which Australian dude?
The guy who owns Fox.
Oh, Rupert Murdoch?
Rupert Murdoch. Yeah. We'll be bigger than Rupert Murdoch in a few weeks.
In a few weeks?
A few weeks.
Let me make place a call to Rupert so he can start quaking in his boots.
Anyway, thanks, everybody. Give us the feedback. Tell your friends. And have a great week. We'll talk to you again next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.